I have some questions here. I also picked up some questions in the back that people left in the basket. And then we'll see where it goes, and maybe you guys will have some questions too. I thought since this kind of had the theme of characters, maybe we could start off with how do you come up with your characters? What is the little seed that grows in your mind when you're starting to write a book or you're starting to think about a new book?
I guess I'll start. It's actually, as the non-illustrator of the group, it's actually images that really get me. Generally, what starts characters is a picture of a kid in an environment, and that's usually the seed. And it sometimes they walk around in your head for years before you finally figure out sort of what's actually happening. But that's where it starts for me.
I think character is actually my weakest skill when it comes to book creation. So for characters, I don't really think, you know, I'll talk to all these other authors and they'll say, you know, I have this character in my head and she's talking to me and she's talking to me and she's telling me to write, and that never happens for me.
Yeah, well, that's because they weren't taking their medication.
Maybe I need some of their medication. So I am more of I like to say I'm not really a writer. I'm not really an illustrator. I'm more of a storyteller. And so to me, the story is what comes first and like what happens. And so a lot of the times, my fallback characters are myself or somebody I know. And then like, for example, the dragon in Where the Mountains Moon, that's my cousin, and I just changed it. Like, while I'm writing it, I'm thinking, that's Austin, blah, blah, blah. and then when it comes to changing it, just change it to, like, dragon. So a lot of times I take people, like, to make the interactions right, I just imagine them as real people in my life and how they would react. So I'm not really a person that, like, creates these magical, intricate characters with huge backstories. I usually just use real people and change the names.
But real people have backstories.
Yes.
And so you're actually just co-opting their backstory.
Yes. I guess I don't use imagined backstories so much.
I start by drawing a character, and I'll draw them quite a few times, and you get to know the character as you're sketching them. And I think with the personalities, I tend to sort of mix and match different personality traits from different people that I know. Sometimes they are just straight up just one person. And sometimes I don't even change their name if I know that they're going to be okay with that. But when it comes to creating characters that then have to work together, I think about personalities that are going to contrast one another. I like to write humorous books, and humor comes when people don't get along, right? Where there's one character who's type A and one character that's type B. So one character likes things really nice and neat, and one character is really messy. Like Ernie and Bert are only funny because they have each other. You know, if Bert wasn't so particular about his bottle cap collection, Ernie's sort of franticness wouldn't be as funny, because, you know, Ernie's franticness is going to really anger Bert. And so you think of that when I'm designing characters, you know, who are they going to be surrounded by that is going to either create friction or humor? And then I also think about what the character wants. And what the character wants could be something physical, like a treasure. The character wants to get this treasure. Or the character wants something that's intangible, like a relationship. And then what that character wants will drive the character's actions. And so I just think at the core, what does this character want? And then that helps me set the character off on whatever adventure, big, grand, or small, they're going on. Whether it's about, you know, fighting crime or not wanting to go to bed when your parent says it's time to go to bed.
Along those same lines, what comes to you first? I know you guys are illustrators. You are strictly writing, I think.
Well, these guys are novelists, too.
No, I know, but I'm just thinking in terms of images and picture, what comes first, the image, the plot, the voice, or the character? I'm just thinking because you guys kind of approach it differently.
My answer is yes. Yes.
Yes?
When you're baking, like, you have to really do things in order as the directions tell you, or the cake is going to taste disgusting. Mm-hmm. But when you're just, like, cooking, you're just mixing things and moving things around. And So there's no like one. There's no like one, two steps, one, two, three, and four. Like, I have a thought of this character, what they look like. You know, a piece of the plot will come trickling in. Maybe I've written the story, and then another character gets inserted. So it's not a linear process.
Though I have to say, I think for me, I think the writing comes first. I might have a simple image in mind, but usually, I mean, not in terms of plot and character, like that is all kind of a mess. But in terms of writing versus illustrating first, I would say writing comes first. If only because that's the way we were taught in art school. Like, they would give us a story, and we would draw from that story. So it's always the writing that would come first. Maybe one image might inspire the writing, but the writing would be the initial start.
Yeah, and I think, too, it's... I guess I'm sort of similar to sort of what Jared said, too. The idea of these things, they inform each other, and there is a kind of an order that you can sort of backtrack through, but it's not necessarily a specific path. Like, this discovery about this character in this chapter will lead me to re-understand the action in a scene like three chapters ago, which leads me to understand the way that the setting needs to be. I mean, it's really this kind of constant reseeding from different places.
And so as someone who's writing and illustrating picture books, you have a set number of pages that you're given. So there's typically 32 pages, maybe 40 pages, but they come in signatures of 8 pages. And so 32 pages is like the sort of very traditional classic number of pages for a picture book. So in order to write that, I also visually, I lay out the book. I make 32 little rectangles to represent each page of the book. And so I can visually see, well, if things aren't starting to wrap up by page 29, I'm not going to have enough time for the following action and resolution of the story. And it's the same thing with graphic novels. With the Lunch Lady book specifically, I've given 96 pages, and you can't go another, you know, signature up from that, another group of pages up from that, because now it's going to be more expensive to produce and make, and there's a whole science and math equations behind how much it costs to produce this book and then how much it's going to cost to retail this book for. The Jedi Academy books are, I think, 167 pages or something like that, or 172 pages. I forget exactly what the number is. So I have to keep that in mind. I'm writing a graphic memoir for young adults, and that was a little different in that I just wrote the script. I tried writing it up visually at first, and I realized I was getting too tripped up on the page turns. And so then with that book, I just wrote it as a script, like a movie is written with a script. And that script came in at 140 pages, and that's translated thus far to about 315 pages of comics.
Oh, fantastic.
So I have noticed, talking to a lot of writers, that stories play a huge important part of our lives, but that it actually started when we were young, the way that we were told family histories, or the way that, you know, like my grandmother used to always tell me what it was like when she first came to the United States, and blah, 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 and how she first saw a banana, she didn't know what the hell it was, and all that. So I'm wondering, like, in your backgrounds and your growing up, what role story played for you? And especially because in your books, you have so many, like, ancient stories that are handed down, it made me think, you know, wow, where did, what, you know?
I guess I'll start it.
Yeah.
So that's a, you know, that seems like a tailor-made question for me. Because, you know, my latest novel, When the Sea Turned to Silver, one of the main themes is, like, the main characters, they find the secret to immortality. And the secret to immortality is stories. And the reason why I chose that, or why, and I truly believe it, it's because I think stories is what connects us to our past, it's what connects us to our future. I mean, when people die, and you go to, not to be too morbid, but when people die and you go to a memorial for them, what do? They sit around and they talk about the stories that they had with them, the experiences they had with them. And then when somebody dies, what it means is those stories that they had, there's no more new stories with them. That means the stories that they had that you don't know, those are gone. That's what has died. And so that's why I feel like stories is really what makes us immortal and kind of gives us life. So that's why I think it's a really important, I think, you know, not to get too lofty about, you know, us as writers and things, sometimes I think we get too self-congratulatory. But I do think what we do is got worth, you know, it's something valuable and it's something that should be treasured. And that's why I'm so glad to see so many people here treasuring books and treasuring stories, because it is really something that we should hold on to.
And growing up.
And so for me, growing up, it's been really interesting because I told you in my, for those of you who came to my presentation, I really was not a fan of my Asian heritage, and the only way that I learned anything about my Asian heritage was my mother sneaking in Chinese folktale books on the bookshelf in the living room. And knowing that I couldn't resist the lure of a new book, I read those folktales. And that's pretty much the only Asian culture that I learned when I was younger. So, and that's probably why the Where the Mountain Meets the Moon series is so important to me, because that is that tenuous connection that I had to my culture when I was younger. But you would think that with all the books that I write that, like, my parents had this great storytelling, like, tradition. And they had a little bit, but not really. I mean, it's actually been since I started writing, I've been able to go to them and say, tell me the story. And that's how I've learned so much. I tell this story about how when I was in Rome, Italy, and I was in Rome, Italy during college studying, and I was at a cafe with a young man, and he said, "Oh, so you're Chinese? Tell me how to say coffee in Chinese." And of course, because I have rejected my culture, I was like, "I don't know anything in Chinese, you know, and I'm American." And he's like, "Okay," and so I explained to him how my parents had moved to the United States, you know, had immigrated. And I could tell he was, like, still kind of confused after, even though I told him, because I was saying this all in Italian to him. And so we're having this conversation in Italian. So my Italian was okay. And so, at the end of the conversation, he said to me, "So your parents moved to the United States from Taiwan. Why?" And it was then that I realized that here I was in the middle of Rome, Italy, speaking Italian, and I could not speak one word of my parents' mother tongue, and I did not know the reason. I did not know why my own parents immigrated to the United States. I could tell him how long it took Michelangelo to paint the Sistine Chapel, I could tell him the mascot of Rome, but I couldn't tell him why my parents immigrated to the United States. And that was a big transformation for me. And from there, I started writing, and that's when I started asking questions, and that's when I started getting the stories, and that's what has really connected me to my family and my roots. So, sorry, I just...
No,
that took
that's
a
okay.
Whole day.
Okay.
I guess my mom tells this story that... I feel like I was raised by my mom and by books. My parents split up when I was young, and my mom was actually pretty busy. And she instilled all these values of sort of hard work and persistence and really, really important stuff. But she wasn't much of a storyteller because she felt like she kind of didn't have time. And I would spend some time with my dad. He was in school at a small college in Missouri. And most of the time we spent together on weekends, he was studying in the library. So I spent a lot of time walking around in the stacks of this college library at like 7. Because it was really, sorry librarians, but it was really good, you know, daycare. And so I discovered a copy of Bullfinch's Mythology, I think when I was around 7. And this is the old sort of early 20th century, late 19th century copy of it's Greek myths, and it's also the sort of the Age of Fable. It's also Arthur's sort of the sort of Arthur and Lancelot and Guinevere stories. And I just ate those up. And so I think for a really long time, my storytellers of my life were these books that I had discovered, and that actually created kind of a twisted understanding of reality, maybe. But I do think that we are, that's what we are. We're made of stories. We're the stories that we tell ourselves, and we're the story that our people tell us about us. And that's why I think it's a really, really, I mean, it's a responsibility to try to tell stories that kind of activate kids in a way that you want them to be activated, I guess. But yeah, so that's my background. But yeah, that's been, stories have been my parents.
So I grew up, I was raised with my grandparents, and there's always, they'd always save the comics strip section of the newspaper for me. They would, you know, give me a ride to the comic book store in town and buy me comics. And my grandfather would read to me at bedtime, and I can remember that. I can remember him reading Dr. Seuss books and the Sneetches and other stories. I can remember the fear I had of those little pants that were running around at night. But my grandfather was definitely a storyteller. He shared so many stories about his time in the Navy, about him, you know, making his way in the world, and this is a great story. But when he, you know, he and my grandmother were married, and he didn't have a job, and he was trying to make some money, and he tried the department store downtown, and they were selling ties for 5 cents. So what little money he had, he bought a dozen ties, and he put them in a suitcase and put nice tissue paper down and went door to door selling these 5 cent ties for 15 cents. And he did that for a couple weeks or a month. He made some good money. And so then he kept going back and, you know, going back and back. And this was like, you know, this would have been like the 40s. So it was like, you know, the classic image of like the housewife at home answering the door to the vacuum salesman kind of thing. And so one day he treated himself to a cup of coffee and a piece of pie at the local diner. And he's sitting at the counter eating his pie and drinking his coffee. And a police officer came and sat next to him, and they were making small talk. And my grandfather said, you know, hey, officer, how's your day going? And the officer's like, well, you know, I'm trying to find this. Apparently there's some guy going door to door selling ties without a license. You haven't seen anything, have you? And my grandfather was like, no. You know, put some money down, he put his cap, his hat on, and walked down. That was the last day he went door to door selling ties, at least in that neighborhood. So like just stories like that he'd share. Then he'd also tell us stories about his time in the deepest, darkest jungles of Africa. And like, we were never sure like what to believe. I mean, they were made up stories. Like, he'd never been to the deepest, darkest jungles of Africa and fought off all of these crazy animals. Like, but he would tell us these stories. He would sit us in the lap and you were right there with him. So, and my grandfather was always the funniest person in the room, and he was such a ham, and he had such a killer sense of humor. And so all of that I got from him, like just watching how he interacted with people.
Thank you.
I have been thinking a lot about cultural appropriation. It's been kind of a big topic in art and in literature, and I was just wondering, you know, for you guys, when is it okay, where do you draw the line? Is it okay, you know, for a man to write in a woman's voice as you do? Is it okay, you know, culturally for you to write about a culture that you don't know? Is it okay for you to, you know...
Sure. Can I start?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that, you know, it's important for us to... So I have books that are just, you know, about kids, not necessarily their culture. So I find it really important that I'm depicting children of all races and genders in those books. So however, I think, you know, this is what would have happened. Say I said, I'm going to write a story about Chinese folktales, right? And I don't, that's not my culture. And if that book did so poorly and it didn't sell, then when Grace came along and she wanted to write about her culture, the publisher would instantly say, Chinese folktales don't sell.
Right.
And so it would not have been my place to have written that. Mm-hmm. But as a white male who's making books, I think that it's important that I have children of color and, you know, Asian children in my books in such a way so that all of the kids that are reading my books can see themselves in there somewhere and see that there are other kids there, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally.
I'm good.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I agree with kind of everything that you said. The thing that I would add too, I'm spending a lot of time doing sort of research about and like one of the weird things about colonial America is that it's really, really difficult to you can't separate the experiences of European colonists from the people who lived here already, right? And there were drafts of the books that I wrote that went deep into essentially like made up indigenous cultures. And I realized in the middle of writing that, and with some of the advice of some really good friends of mine, some of whom are First Nations, that I just didn't have the bandwidth to write that experience, and it also would be incredibly sort of dismissive and also kind of really, really too full of yourself to try to do something like that. So I think that's also part of it is, and one person, we were talking about this a lot, and the thing that was really important to me as a person from, like, for example, with Ruby, as a person who's biologically male, the one thing I can try to do really deeply is write her not as primarily female. Like her signal, her characteristic that is most important is not that she's female, right? It's that she's a really, really complex person that's difficult to sort of articulate. So I think that's also part of it, is trying to write people not necessarily as just representatives of their culture or their ancestry or their heritage, but as humans as well.
Okay, so I think the problem with all this talk about cultural appropriation and writing outside your box or your lane or something like that, I think there's two separate things that people are kind of mixing up. One is the artistic vision of being able to write anything. And the truth is, I believe in that. I believe anybody should write whatever they want. That's what art is for. It's like, it's boring if you only write what you know. Like, you know, it's boring. Like, I don't even write what I know. You know, you write what you want to know. And so everybody should have the freedom to be able to write whatever they want. So you have the creative side, but you have the other side. And this is where the cultural appropriation and this is the side of equity. And equity is a really hard thing to get in industries that have been around for a long time, especially in publishing is one of the oldest industries that have been around for a long time. And so it's just like what Jared said, you know, it's a lot easier for a white person to get a book done, get a book with a black character made, than it is for a black person. And that's not equitable, you know? And it's also, if the white person writes the book, the Asian book, and it fails, they can still go back and write another book. If an Asian person writes an Asian fantasy and it fails, then it's like, oh, Asian fantasy's over, and there's nothing, then, you know, then, and that Asian person, like, I'm kind of stuck, you know, like, there's not too many other avenues left for me because they don't want me to write outside of my lane, you know, so it's a very interesting, difficult problem, and it's trying to figure out how can we balance the idea, the creative idea that all artists believe in, yet also the idea of justice for people who have been underrepresented, you know? So, and that's something that you just have to figure out your own moral compass, you know? Like, and as an artist, you have to really, like, the worst thing you can be as an artist is be thoughtless, you know? And so if you do this thoughtlessly, then that's terrible. I mean, then you lose a lot of respect for other artists. That's my personal feeling. But if you're thoughtful about it, and you just have to go by your own moral compass, is this what is right? Is this what you feel is what the world deserves, what it needs? And then you go from there. And if you feel like this is what you must do, then do it, you know? But don't do it thoughtlessly. I guess that's what it is.
So I wanted to know if you have already written the book you've always wanted to write, or is that still coming, or are you working on it?
I mean, it's I think my answer is, it's the most sort of boring of answers, but it's always the next book. Like, I'm
And you have to then tell me what it is if you haven't written it.
Well, I don't know. I think the book of your life is maybe your last book, or for me it is. I'm not sure if there will ever be like, I don't want to measure myself by any sort of thing that I have favorite stories, but one I'm working on right now is kind of taking the alternate history thing and turning it on its side and having it, and it takes place in Butte in the early 20th century. But because there's a lot of stuff that's there to unpack, but as far as like, I hope that I haven't written the book of my life yet, because I want to always improve, and I've got a lot of room to improve, I think.
Well, it feels like I wrote the book of my life, like my last book, because it was such a bugger to write. Like, not because it's like my best book ever, yeah, but just because it was so painful. And after I finished that, I was like, that's the book of my life.
So, and I can vouch. So Grace and I live down the street from one another, and there's a group of us authors who get together. And she was pretty frazzled for a good amount of time. Yeah.
And I'm just like, I'm done. That's the book of my life. But you always, all artists have, like, hope springs eternal that your next book is going to be even better, and the next book's going to be even better after that. And then there's always that hope that the next book will be the one that is your best book ever. So even though I'm afraid that my last book was the book of my life, I still hope that the next one's coming.
So I am working on the final artwork for my graphic memoir. It's called Hey Kiddo, and it'll be out in the fall of 18. And it traces my life from, even from before birth. I talk about the stories my grandfather told me about the Thai salesman, the time of his life. So it covers a little bit of my family history, but it deals with the 17-year-old Jarrett dealing with mother's incarceration and drug addiction and father's first appearance right before high school graduation. And I know that this will be the most important book that I'll ever write. I know that it's not to say that Lunch Lady doesn't have value, because I know those books have really connected with kids in a way that turned them on to writing and illustrating and loving books. And there's importance and weight in those silly books as well. But I just know that since it's such a unique experience and I'm sharing it in such a unique way, that I know that I could live to be 100 years old and write another 100 books, and none of them will be as important as this one. I hope they're fantastic. You know, I hope that they're well received. They will be important, but I know that this is it. This book is going to be the cornerstone of my life's work.
I just want to add to that, just because I kind of gave a flippant response, and I want to put a little bit more depth to that. I think that, and to add to Jarrett's, I mean, I think that I think it is probably the book of your life right now. But the thing about life is that life changes. You know, yeah. Like I wrote Where the Mountains and the Moon after my first husband died, and a lot of it was about of what I self-discovered after his death. And at that point, that book was the book of my life, you know. But so, like I said, so your life changes. Like now, I have a daughter. I just did this new picture book, and it's with her in it. And I'm like, this is the book of my life, because there's so much love. You're like being a mom, you know. Like it's such a different part of your life, and it means so much. So you don't know. Like it might be another 20 years. Like there'll be something even more.
I don't know. I mean, I see what you're saying, but I think that this is going to be a book that will give kids that went through what I went through, dealing with opioid addictions and their parents, a book that they don't have, right?
That's
so
true.
So I'm thinking in terms of that, in terms of how this book is going to reach. I might have other books that are way better written and much better illustrated, but I do think that, I think this is it. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, even some of our friends who live in town, like Mo Willems, he'll be 50 in early 2018, and he's done making Elephant and Picky books, and he's kind of like, that's my life's work. And Janie Birdsall, the Pendricks books, she knows she'll make other books, but she looks at that as like, that's the thing, you know. But it's gonna be different for every, but likewise, they all could surprise us, or surprise themselves, I should say, and put something out there that,
I think that's what it is. It's about surprise. I think that when you look at what you've done, I think when you look at what you've done, and then you kind of put it, like, I understand that, like, I've done this Where the Mountain Meets the Moon trilogy, and I'm like, okay, that is done for now, you know, like, or that's done. But I think that if you put an ending saying, that is my life's work, like, okay, I'm done. I think that's very dangerous, because it's kind of like, you know, when something ends, you have to remember something begins, you know? And so that's why it's like, maybe that is my life's work for that part of my life. And then you have to keep then saying, what's in my new life and what will be the work in my new part of my life? I guess that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
So we'll come back in 30 years.
Yes.
And I'm going to be like, I still think Hey Kiddo is it.
Or, and I'll be like, no, you're new. That's it.
Yeah. And then we got some questions from the audience. We had a little question box over there. How do you get past writer's block? Whoever wants to start.
I'm always starting.
Because you sat there.
I know, I did. I made a mistake. I threw off.
See, because
you guys have
you just finished your first trilogy.
I know, not to sit at that
table. No.
The Padawan learns. I think the way that I get over... I grew up in the theater, and I grew up making plays, and I think that that gave me a really great understanding of tomorrow you're doing the show whether you like it or not and whether you're ready or not. And I think that for me that really, really goes into writer's block as well. It took me a long time when I was doing other stuff to realize that all you can do is try something. And if you're trying something, you're not blocked. You're just trying something. And what you're trying is probably really terrible. And then you can look at it and see that it's terrible, and then you can try the next thing, and then you can try the
next
thing.
Does your improv training help with that?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. But just that idea of, because the idea is never, I'm going to make this beautiful thing. It's like your presentation, right? When, just now when we're talking about graphic novels, and you're like, no, it's done, right? No, it's not done. It's just ready to be edited. And so I think the thing that creates writer's block is the desire to create a perfect sentence or the need to create like a thing that will never be touched again. And so, I get stuck there all the time. Just saying I like these behaviors are familiar to me doesn't mean that I'm not sitting there going, but for me, I think it's more of a mindset sort of question. If I can trick myself into being into the productive mindset as opposed to the self-hating one, I think that's a better place to be.
So writer's block. I think writer's block is an interesting idea because I feel like everybody has so many ideas. You know, they're always like, I got a good idea. Everybody, I feel like ideas are so easy. And so writer's block is really taking all of those ideas and sitting down and like actually making those ideas come to life. And it's like actually sitting down to do the work. So I don't know, I actually kind of never really, really believed in writer's block in the traditional sense. I feel like authors can get burnt out and they need a break. I feel like authors need to recharge. But in terms of writer's block, I never really believed it in terms of like, I can't think of anything, you know? Like, I can't think of anything. Like, true. It's like, mm-hmm. And like, nothing.
Writer's block is like the third chapter.
Yeah.
You know?
The middle, the dreaded middle.
Yeah. But, so, I'll let you go.
I think it's important to do other things. I mean, go for a walk. It's great to have dogs because then they need to go out, right? So you take them for a walk. Or it's when you're doing mindless things, like, you know what, like, you're on your morning commute when you're driving, and you get to where you're going and you're like, I don't remember getting here, right? Because you just do it so automatically. When you do automatic things, that opens up another part of your brain to start working. So mowing the lawn or just taking a shower, taking a walk, and that's when this other thing might go, oh, that's what it needs to be. But it's also time and patience. So like I have a whole bunch of ideas, and to me they're like, they're patiently waiting in that waiting room to get called, to be next in, to go see the author and get written. But then sometimes there's been an idea that's been in that waiting room for like 5 years, and this new idea comes in and like they get called right away because I know exactly what I need to do with that idea.
Though I do have to say, like, I never really believed in writer's block, but like recently, I guess, recently I believe in like emotional block. I guess. Like, you know, after the election, I was so devastated. And I'm still devastated in a lot of ways. And, like, I just couldn't write. You know, I just couldn't write. And I still, like, and I still can't write. Honestly, like, my editors were like, are you going to write another novel? And I was like, oh, I don't think so. Like, it's just, I just don't have it because I'm so emotionally spent by so many things. So, like, so what I do is I turn, like, so I've turned to picture books. I found that as, like, my safe space to, like, create. I think what you have to do is you have to find different avenues to create if you can, if you have that kind of block emotionally from to do other things.
Yeah, and that's to be said for like anything that's like if you're like feeling really depressed and stuck about whatever's happening in your life, you know, you have to be in a fairly good space to write sometimes, you know. I mean, for me at least, you know, for me sometimes it's like I need to have a clean space. So if my studio is super messy, I just, the clutter is just doing this to the muscles in my back, and I just have to take couple hours and put things away on the bookshelf and tidy up, and that also helps clear up your brain some. So there's so much, like your environment is so important. To have a space that you feel good about working in is so important.
And I feel too, it for me it's about fuel as well. It's about what kind of art I'm eating. When I'm eating good art, it sets me off in a way that, and not necessarily like, oh, this is art that I will replicate over here because it's good. It doesn't even have to even remotely resemble the thing that I'm making right now. But if I find a wonderful film, or if there's a new artist that I'm introduced to, or a new poet, or something like that, and I start really consuming stuff that really gets me going, that absolutely feeds into my work. And also, when I eat junk food and I don't exercise my spirit, it like kills what I'm making. It's really, the older I get, I feel like that's exactly what happens over and over. And I have to learn this lesson over and over and over again.
Yeah. Like if I have too much coffee before lunch, I'm too wired.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And we have one more question and then we'll open it up to the audience. What do you love about being an author? Just pick one thing.
I don't know. I mean, it's the book signing thing, right, is pretty great. I'm still new to this whole dance, but wow, it's pretty cool to have someone come up to you with a big smile on their face and talk to you about the story that you shared with them and that you made together. I think that's really kind of the coolest thing. That's me.
Yeah, I think that's pretty close to me too. I think the thing is, like, the saddest thing that can happen to you as a creator, any kind of artist, is to create something and put all your heart and soul and like work so hard on it, put it on the world, and realize nobody cares. You know, like that is like the most heartbreaking thing, to realize that you've created something and nobody cares. And so when the opposite happens and you create something and people come up to you and say how much they do care and how much this actually touched them, that it actually meant something, it, all of a sudden it's just like, yes, you see what I saw that is beautiful in the world. We, you know, like there's a connection, and all of a sudden you feel like a part of the world, and it's probably the most, that I think is probably the most fulfilling feeling about being an author.
I would say, you know, for me, part that I enjoy the most in terms of just the creative process is that moment when you've had this idea for months, typically you've had this idea for years, and you finally know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you finally say, oh, that's what this has to be. This is what it's meant to be. That moment is so exciting. It's like fireworks.
Mm-hmm. Just hang on to that, because we're going to ask the audience.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah.
So, just talk about the industry a little bit. I know as children's or young adult or juvenile authors, it is really hard if you don't make a whole lot of money, typically, and you have to go out and do these kinds of things, more so than I think of authors for adult books have to do, is sort of go out and peddle themselves and get into school visits. And do you like that? Do you not like that? How does that fit into your creative process, into your writing, into...
Well, I think adult authors tend to do it, you know, they teach at colleges, because I have a lot of friends who write for grown-ups, you know, and then they're professors. But it's kind of like everything I do is because I make these books. So it's what a blessing that I get, you know, paid to speak at places to talk about myself and my books, and then people want to line up and have me doodle in them, right? Like, that's amazing. If I could teleport places, that would be great. I've had some nightmare flight experiences recently. But I had a point that I was going to make. So think of it this way. You know, I feel like librarians who host authors at their schools or host authors and illustrators at their libraries, you're like a patron of the arts. So because you are hiring an author to come speak, then that's helping fund the next book project of theirs. Because now you can pay the mortgage and the bills and all that kind of stuff. And I could spend some quiet time in my studio writing and illustrating. Because everyone knows the way publishing works, it's advanced against royalties. So they put together, if they pick up the book, they put a PLN statement, profits and loss. I think P&L, profits and loss. I don't know, the acronym doesn't make sense, but that's what they call it. And they figure out, like, this is how many copies we think we would sell. And this is how much it would cost to make the book. So this is how much we can give as an advance to the author. Say author, illustrator. And then they'll get a third of that upon signing the contract, a third upon that upon finishing the manuscript, and a third of that upon finishing the artwork for the book. Now that could be 2, 3, 4 years in between. Then the book comes out a year later. And if you're the author of a hardcover, you're going to get 5%. As the illustrator, you get 5%. So say if you're the author illustrator, it's a hardcover picture book that retails for, say, $16, you get $1.60 eventually, right? So, but once that 10% equals whatever amount they gave you 2, 3 years ago, then the royalty has met the advance, and then you will start getting royalties down the line. Now, your royalties might not ever make back the advance. You never have to give back the advance. But so a couple times a year, I'll receive a statement, and but this is pretty neat. Like, you know, this book that was published in 2001 sold so many copies, and there's a little bit of money it made, right? And that happens too because we're also actively book touring too. I mean, I would feel like when you think of some authors who might choose to just stay at home, then they might not be making that royalty statement down the line. So it's just, I mean, I grew up in a blue-collar household where I was taught to work, and my grandfather's hands were soiled with the oils and the machines that he worked with, and I have, like, Crayola marker stains in hands, you know? This is different. It's work, you know?
Yeah, I think, I feel like we're in a different part of our career. I mean, there's some authors who don't go out as much as we do. But I think I kind of see it as part of the work, and it's just like all work. There's some really amazing fulfilling part, and there's always like the hard part. The fulfilling part is like when we meet great people like you. The hard part is getting into the airplane, getting up 5 a.m, leaving your family. You know, like that's really rough. So it's just to me, it's kind of part of the job. But it is hard. I mean, I especially for like someone like me. Like if you asked me, you know. My first book is 1999. Like, if you asked me, like, 17 years ago, you know, what I expected being an author and illustrator was going to be like, I would have thought, like, oh, I'm just going to sit in my room, and I'm just going to paint, and I'm going to write my stories, send it out. Like, I never thought I was going to be, like, here, sitting in front of people, talking, giving speeches, like, talking, like, and going to all these different places and meeting and traveling all over the world. It's hard for a lot of authors to realize that that's part of the job. And there's part of things that you just have to accept it.
There's a misconception that it's not part of the job. Like we're doing this because we have to. I mean, we could choose to just visit schools that are down the street from us or in Massachusetts. But like, I get to go to Montana. Like I've been to now 47 of the continental United States to do these kind of talks, you know, and like, And people will always ask when I'm traveling, oh, you're going to do some sightseeing. Well, sightseeing is really boring compared to getting driven around by somebody who lives here and like just learning about some of the small idiosyncrasies of this place or that place.
I think One of the things that I that it balances for me, doing workshops and spending time with kids and spending time in schools and spending time in different places. One of the things that balances for me is if I'm just focusing on my navel all the time, it starts to make me go a little bit cuckoo. I feel like teaching and talking about creative work actually helps me get better at doing what I do.
Yeah.
It helps me articulate things that I, the way that I want to work, and also it helps me realize things that I never would have realized if I was by myself just working. And I also feel like it is a way to engage with that idea of like being creative inside of your life, which I think is a really, really important thing. And harnessing the imagination for kids is a really important thing that in schools and in school districts gets smaller and smaller as part of the way that school gets taught. So if I can help out with that, I'm happy to do it. It's exciting.
Also, you know, as creators, if we sit at home and we put our books out, you know, you never get to see it used. You never get to see it come alive. And like the wonderful thing about coming out to these things is like, oh, you get to see your work in the wild. You get to see it come alive. You get to see like it's actually becoming a part of people's lives and their culture, and it's kind of, and that is the whole reason why we became artists. So,
And as creative people, we tend to be very insecure. So, like, you know, when these kids were coming up to get their awards today, this one kid just whispers, "Goes, he said, you're my hero."
Yeah, that was
and I was like, "That's clearly why I came to Montana." Like, that was, I'll carry that with me for all of my days.
But we have time for one more question.
Because I drank this whole iced coffee and I so make it a quick one.
In the back?
Yeah, we all have different ideas about how to complete this, but I just wanted to know what your ideas were for, you were talking, Grace was talking about equity, and how do we inspire our children to be equitable to one another? How do we represent equity in our lives, in our communities? You know, how would you recommend, you know, like I said, everybody has different ideas, right?
I'm going to go first, and then I'm going to run to the bathroom.
in these
recent months where you've seen so many terrible things and hateful and awful things unfolding across the country, and you're often asking yourself, like, what can I do? Or, can I post something on Facebook that's going to change the world? You know, and I'm realizing, like, well, like, I have this incredible privilege to be welcomed into the imaginations of young people, right? And I can create stories that can elicit empathy, and I can create characters that children can aspire to. And so there are times when I think, like, how am I doing work that's important? And then I have to take a step back and being like, even though it's kind of a slow burn because publishing is a really slow process, you know, if I'm putting out stories out there that are even if it's just a story that's making somebody happy, if, you know, a kid is laughing at lunch lady using food words as expletives, you know, like she says good gravy and sweet peas and carrots, you know, like if that's going to make a kid just like laugh and escape. Because I have met, you know, there's this one mother who, through tears when I was signing a book for her, explained that she had escaped an abusive relationship, and it was like the lunch lady books were the only thing that kept her daughter afloat, you know, reading those silly, funny books.
Why don't you go? Because I could talk about it for a long time and maybe
talk about that.
I think as a straight white bald guy, I think part of what I want to focus on is what I want to focus on in the world is the way we raise boys in this country. I think actually there's a really wonderful amount of attention right now on creating strong figures of girls and getting girls into places where they're surrounded by other powerful women who can help them move forward in a way that is excellent for them and for the world. But I feel like there's a for me and it's not anybody's job except for it's sure mothers and women can be part of this, but it's men's job to like really take young boys under their wings and teach them how to be better, I think. And I know that that's a small thing that I'm only focused on, but I can be an ally for others, but I also need to tend my backyard. And my backyard is my biology in some ways. And I don't mean to be like really trying to be very, very specific about it, but I think I get a sense that the idea in the world right now is that, well, men, and it's men will be men, right? And there's a sort of a shrug of the shoulders, and we have to take care of everything else and just let them do that. And I don't really accept that. I think that's wrong-headed in some ways. And it's also doing a disservice to everybody else who's really trying to fix this thing.
So your question was about how do we bring equity to, I guess, the lives of our kids and all of this. I do lots of talks and I do lots of lectures about these kind of things. Like, I have a TEDx talk that's like the windows and mirrors of your child's bookshelf. You know, because obviously there's other things you can do. You can march, you can do all these politics, all these different things. But of course, as a children's book creator, I turn to books, and I assume all of you are here because you love books. So I think our first thing that we go to is books to try to get equity in our kids' lives. And so that always goes to diverse books. It goes to making sure that the books, like, really take stock of your child's bookshelf, take stock of your child's classroom bookshelf, look at the books, you know, and make sure that there are both, you know, I talk about windows and mirrors, you know, books that show kids images of themselves and also shows them a window out into the world. And it's not enough just to have one or two. It's not enough to have even five. Like, they really make it balanced. Make sure that they're balanced, you know. And it's but that even goes beyond the bookshelf. It goes to yourself. Like, think about yourself. How are you yourself reading? What are the books that you love? Do you only read YA vampire fiction? Like, if that's all that you're reading, that's showing, like, you have to break out of your own kind of reading box and then look into that and then share that with your kids so they can break out of their own reading box, and hopefully with that, and then you can talk about it. And hopefully with that, you can see more of the world. You can have these conversations about empathy. You have all these conversations about social justice. You can have all these conversations about things that you never really thought of before, and using these books as kind of the tools to bring you there. And that is where I think it can be really powerful. And that's where you just, it's kind of like you're saying, tending your own backyard. That's where we have to start, like our own backyard, bringing up our kids and ourselves the best we can, and then hopefully make it spread from there.
Well, thank you all. You were so great to have on a panel. You were honest and open and funny and
I lied the whole time.
So,
quite convincingly.
I just want to thank them.
Because I'm a storyteller.
Yeah.